Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the South Dakota Festival of Books, and this hour we welcome two authors to the stage at once, partially because they both have breakout debut novels and partially because they are married. So Julie Bunton is here with us. She is the author of a book called Marlena, and Gabe Havish is the author of Stephen, Florida. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
I'm very excited for our audience here because there's a fair chance that a lot of people in the crowd do not know either one or both of these books, and they are about to have an amazing treat, as sort of the literary world did when these books kind of landed on the scene. So before we get into really the conversation, let's ground people in what we're talking about. So Marlena, a little bit about Marlena. After her parents' divorce, 15-year-old Kat moves to rural Michigan. She lives with her mother, who is ill-prepared for financial independence, and her older brother, whose gap year after high school descends into a future that is arguably less than what he is capable of. In Silver Lake, Kat meets Marlena. She's wild, reckless, and forgotten Marlena. Now, the reader knows within the first chapter that Marlena will die within a year, and that Kat will carry that legacy of that year well into her own adulthood. Marlena is a novel of urgency and addiction. It's a novel about memory and the stories we tell ourselves about who we were and who we are becoming. So a little bit, so people are kind of grounded in Marlena, and I'm wondering if we could just start with an excerpt, if you might read for us part of the book.
Yeah, I would love to, and thank you for that beautiful introduction to the book. Basically, the setup is perfectly done. I'll just say that Kat is looking back on this time from her early 30s, and the book is kind of told in alternating sections close to the past and close to her present. Her friend died from complications related to substance abuse, heroin really, and oxy. And the narrator, Kat, is struggling with some addiction issues of her own, which was my way of investigating addiction kind of across the spectrum of the ways that it influences lives. So I'm gonna read a section that's kind of outside of time and not really story forward, but a way of thinking about how Kat thinks and sees the world. Drink to being a girl. Drink to how every day we had less time left. Drink to only being each age once. Drink to her hair in sunlight, in snow, in the parking lot of Walmart, in the minutes between twilight and dark, just after the lamps switch on. Her hair underground, below the lake surface when you open your eyes and it swirls between you so you can't quite see her grinning, bubbles escaping from her mouth. Drink to powder. Drink to a face in a rearview window, the way the room smell changes when he comes in, the tear in her voice when she whispers, "I'm not afraid." Drink to condoms. Drink to birthdays, to saying I love you, to saying no. Drink to doing it for the money. Drink to nicknames. Drink to the bitter drip in the back of your throat. Drink to closing your eyes when you swallow. Drink to a yes you don't mean. Drink to knowing her less than 1 year. Drink to questions without answers. Drink to raising your hand to asking anyway. Drink to it was just a summer. Drink to a cut on the upper part of your arm, how blood has nothing to do with the way something hurts. Drink to holding the knife. Drink to salt. Drink to never forgetting, and drink again to the lie you tell when you say you won't. Drink to where what's forgotten goes. Raise your glass. Drink to trying, like this, to bring her back. I'll stop there.
Julie Bunton with a little bit of Marlena. And Stephen, Florida, which wins the book design contest of the, because this cover of, I don't know, what is this?
It's a Canadian lynx.
Thank you. A Canadian lynx pinning down a...
Snowshoe hare.
Snowshoe hare. Thank you for the... which you get the sort of muscularness of this book, which is really a novel of obsession on the edge of madness. The protagonist is a college wrestler in small town North Dakota. His parents are gone. He has entered the world with a clerical error and a mythology, and he seeks to violently pin his dream as he tests the limits of his body and his fears and the darkness of his own mind. A little something from Stephen, Florida. You're going to start us right at the beginning.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. This is just the opening of the book, so it doesn't need that much more context. My mother had two placentas, and I was living off both of them. I was supposed to have a twin. When the doctor yanked me out, he said, "There's a good chance this child will be quite strong." This is the story my parents always told me, but I never really believed it. In a moment, after I refasten the Velcro over my laces, I will stand up out of this folding chair. I will square my bulge in my singlet and good luck tug each shoulder strap. And after I've counted the spectators in the bleachers, 17, I will ask Coach Hargraves to box my headgear. He will oblige. Then I will walk onto the maroon mat, enter the white circle, shake this poor Richard's hand, and when the referee lets me go, I will come after him with everything I have. Noise. And in the second it takes for me to hold the pin, I will hear something snap in his arm. This is like breathing. You haven't spent any time in North Dakota, but if you had, you know this time of year is useful for airing out your head. I will use 3 minutes outside in the parking lot to stand by a snow clump, watching for birds and settling down, thinking how it's finally November, and the season won't be over until March, thinking about my weak, sweaty goodbye to the whole thing before it gets sucked inside me for good. I once read about the idea of internal age in my teams and group dynamics class. I got a C+ in that. Imagine there's a tight little peach pit core inside you with a number carved into it, and that number is the age of your best self. Most of the time, people whine about not being at or being past their internal age. Not me. I'm in my golden age. I believe in wrestling, and I believe in the United States of America. I'll stop there.
These are two books that are both set in what some people would consider the middle of nowhere. Let's talk about place a little bit and how you chose the places that you would go and have us look in on these characters that really, in a lot of ways, no one else is watching.
Yeah.
And that's part of the appeal, right? Julie, why don't you start, please?
Yeah, I kind of chose that place for the most personal and easy reason of all, which is that it's where I'm from. I'm from a small town in northern Michigan, Petoskey area, for those of you who might know, but really kind of like a Lansing, which is about a 15-minute, 20-minute drive away from that town. 5,000 people year-round in Petoskey, way fewer in a Lansing, and then in the summer, there's a huge influx of tourists who come for the lake and the natural beauty. And for me, it was such an interesting place to grow up and a beautiful place to grow up in so many ways, but also challenging place to grow up because of the economics of a summer town. The fact that there's incredible privilege, incredible wealth, and incredible difference for the people who support that industry via house cleaning, which is something that my family did, or window washing that dries up over the winter. The winters are brutal, the summers are glorious. The kind of contrast baked into that seemed so novelistically rich to me. And furthermore, I left home a little bit like Kat, the narrator of my book, and I just longed to go back there. I'm homesick for that kind of natural world, so I think I was drawn to imagining it as a way of going home, kind of.
Yeah. Gabe, a place where nobody's watching, nobody's ever yeah. been, and you've never been there either.
Right. So, yeah, I'm from Ohio originally, and I've lived in Miami, Florida for college, and then now Julie and I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I've always been drawn to, you know, sort of vast open spaces, and particularly because I live in the opposite of that in Brooklyn, I like to, you know, put myself in a different position mentally and from a different perspective when I write. And so I was always drawn to having this setting where a character is sort of existing in isolation, and particularly all of the other things in his life are gone, so he has this sort of tunnel vision that reflects the landscape around him. In particular, I picked North Dakota. It's set in a fictional college in a fictional town in the center of North Dakota. It's a school called Oregsburg. You don't see a lot of what exists beyond the periphery of the college campus in the book. It is very, like I said, it's a very tight focus on what Steven is interested in, which is winning his weight class in wrestling. And in particular, the setting made sense to me because there are, you know, these powerhouse programs like Iowa and, you know, Oklahoma and a lot of big schools around the, particularly concentrated in the middle of the country. And the story that I was trying to tell because of Steven's isolation just wouldn't make sense if he was wrestling at a Division I school or a school with a lot of exposure where he has like people who know who he is. I wanted some place where he would be pursuing something that nobody else was really paying attention. So you hit the nail on the head with no one else is paying attention.
And yet he arrives with this sort of epic mythology.
Yes.
You know, there's two placentas and I get both of them. I am, you know, I am this. Talk a little bit about him bringing that into the first chapter of the story, bringing that into, you know, onto the mat with him every single time. What's the significance of that sort of outsized origin story?
Right. So yeah, he's not only obsessive, he's also lonely, and those two dynamics were something that I was really interested in exploring, and how they play off of each other. And his confidence starts off at the beginning. The opening that I read is his first match of the season in November, and the structure of the book follows his season, which ends in March. And some obstacles happen during the course of the season that interrupt his confidence, so you can see it shifting. But at the beginning, it's his senior season, and he's never won his championship in his weight class, so he's basically has all of his eggs in one basket. And so he's almost overly confident in psyching himself up, because he's so he cares so much about winning this one thing, and he, at the cost of everything else in his life, he doesn't have any his parents died in a car accident about 8 or 10 years before the events in the book. He doesn't really have any meaningful human relationships. He's sort of not paid attention in school because he doesn't really care about what comes after this one season. So at the beginning, though, in the section that I just read, he's built this whole mythology, and it's the one of the main dynamics I wanted is this sort of separation between what Steven thinks about himself and then what the outside world thinks of him. So and it's something you obviously get more of what Steven thinks, because it's a first person, very tight perspective and what he thinks, but throughout the book you hopefully see the outside world like reflected back on him. So while you get this, you know, very like confident and brash language in Steven's perspective, he is wrestling at this school that is Division IV, which isn't even a real division in wrestling, and
133 weight class or something. It's not
high stakes.
And there's 17 people in the bleachers, like I just read, and so he cares so much, but then, you know, you get these glimpses of what the actual objective reality looks like to other people. So that difference was interesting to me.
As you look for, and I didn't oversell it this, but I need to sort of provide some evidence for how these novels have really made a splash, is, you know, with the reviews and in the literary community, but also when you look at just readers and some of the comparisons that they make, you know, like, this is Holden Caulfield only violent. this is, I was pretty far into Marlene, and I was like, this is The Outsiders. And I started seeing these, you know, these layers of, these are the people that nobody has paid attention to. These are the people with no direction. These are the people who are destined to crash. Mm-hmm. And now there's girls in this conversation, mm-hmm. Too, who are bent on self-destruction. And I could see some, you know, some outsiders in there, and other people making other comparisons. What is the reception? And fortunately, because you're married, they are both getting great reception, because it would really be unfortunate if one was slipping into oblivion and the other was doing really well. But what has some of the response been for you? Have you sort of handled that as writers and as a couple?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm grateful for the comparison to The Outsiders, which is a book that I love. It's just, you're just grateful that, I mean, this sounds corny, but you work on a book for so long, all alone, and with no real, and this process was an emotional book to write. It's, spoiler alert, it's a very sad book. Just feel like I should be upfront about that. And then to find people picking it up and responding to it, it's like you almost can't, I had trouble imagining that step as a writer before, like in the writing process. So it happening now feels like a dream. And I mean, for me, the kind of reviews and things like that are all gravy, but the stuff that's really meaningful is when someone who has had an experience with addiction or has lost someone, a friend, a family member, finds something in it that is authentic to them, or something that they can identify with or relate to, or that gives them there's just some solace in knowing that your experience is not yours alone. And there's so much shame when we think about addiction stories and the people that we love who struggle with these things. There's so many lies and so many like cover-ups, and no one wants to kind of talk about it. And if it makes a little more space for us to be open about what a serious problem this is, then I'm just honored to be part of that conversation.
There's this moment where Kat is in the library. She's, you know, she's cutting class, and you know, she's already, you know, kind of on the edge. And then this Marlena and the circle of friends, and they come, and she sees them in the window, and she gets up and she goes with them. And at that moment, you sort of capture this: I know what I am doing right now is the wrong thing to do. and I'm watching myself do it anyway.
Yeah. Which is something that I think we talk about with male adolescents a lot, right? Like, boys will be boys, and they'll do these things, and it's sort of forgiven. But what happens when girls make those choices? I was interested in that, certainly.
Yeah. Gave some of the response to, you know, John Irving and, you know, other sort of epic stories and authors.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I agree with everything that Julie said. It's you write these books, and they come from a place of something. There's always something that you care about enough to spend years of your life writing about, right? And so this one, you know, I was really interested in writing about somebody who is lonely and depressed and experiences solitude in a very profound way. And I mean, it's what Julie said with, I mean, one of the great things that reading gives us is allows us to see another perspective. And, you know, it might be a perspective that we don't normally experience. And so we can learn about someone else's shoes, and then conversely, you know, it could be somebody that we see ourselves in. And so, you know, when I've heard people, you know, like talk about the emotional aspects of the book with Stephen's depression and his loneliness, that's meant a lot to me. And also the wrestling is obviously a very important aspect of the book. So hearing from people who are wrestlers or people who have family members or friends that are wrestlers and saying that, like, they recognize their friends or family in Stephen. His more admirable qualities. He's not always the most upstanding citizen.
You'll step back a little bit and say, yeah.
But yeah, when I hear someone saying, like, I know, I went to high school with that guy, that, like, that means a lot to me.
Yeah, that licked the mat to just
break. Yes.
Yeah. You know, and we, yeah, we should say I'm excited because they're such, you know, well-crafted books, but yeah, they're not, you know, light-hearted romps through, you know, through the American landscape.
Yeah, no.
We're going to take a break and come back with more with Julie and Gabe in just a moment. We're broadcasting live from the South Dakota Festival of Books today on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting live today from the South Dakota Festival of Books in Brookings. We have two authors on the stage with us right now. Julie Bunton, she's the author of Marlena, and Gabe Havish is the author of Stephen, Florida, two novels, and a married couple working. And at this point, you know, when you're in school and you're working together on novels, there's no point in just writing anything, right? You know, so there's so much that's out there. You have to write something that moves the conversation forward. The pressure is, it's easy to get lost and to never find your way as writers. How do you sort of support one another during the process of putting something together that could take years to develop?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I think you first have to know what the, in our situation, I have to know what Julie wants to get out of the project and why she cares so much, because it's what I said earlier about that original kernel, that thing that is the thing that makes it worth spending years of your life working at and trying to perfect, or not perfect, but at least make as good and strong as possible. And first understanding that, and then doing your best to support that person with making that as clear as possible. But yeah, I mean, we've read each other's work for years, and I think we just have we're lucky to have like an intuitive sense of each other's work. And just speaking from my own work, the book would be totally different without Julie's involvement, and way worse. So yeah.
That's nice. I feel the same way. It's hard to, I've only been married once, and I don't know, it's kind of hard to describe, because I don't know if other marriages have this like sort of like working component that is really like a collaborative, creative thing. But it's something that I'm really grateful for, that if I need a reader, one of the best readers that I know is in my house. So I can be like, is this bad? Sometimes that's can be stressful, because if Gabe says it's bad, I trust him. And so then I know that it's bad and I need to go back to it and try again. But it is kind of
convenient.
Let's hope
he's in a good, I mean, you know.
Right.
So like, he can manipulate that.
It's
terrible.
I know, right.
Put that away. Put that
project away. Try again. But it's nice to not have to like outsource your reading in that sense, and to kind of have that reliable second opinion kind of really close at hand. It's hard in other ways, though. Like, we lived for a long time in a really small apartment in Brooklyn, and the best writing spot was right by the window in this patch of sunlight, and it was, like, my spot. I set it up, and then Gabe would always get there before me, and it was like we didn't have two spaces to write in. So, you know, those kinds of logistical things can be challenging.
You never have to explain why the work is important.
Yeah. That's very true. That's very true. Though we still had some, definitely during the process of working on this book, I'm a little bit more... I'll write for like long periods of time, like hours and hours on end, and Gabe is a little more like spread out. And sometimes you'd be like, let's go to the movies. And I'd be like, I don't know, maybe later.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to have sort of exactly tracks that lined up. Like Julie's book and my book came out within 6 or 8 weeks of each other,
which
I mean is incredibly rare and lucky. But yeah, I mean, Julie will write in huge swaths of time, and I'll write more regularly every day, just in shorter bursts. And it's just a matter of understanding the other person
and respecting it.
But at the core, I mean, it's the same. Like, we understand. Yeah, it's what you said. You never have to explain why you're
right.
Why the work is important. You just know.
Julie, talk to me a little bit about female friendship and just really how it's explored in Marlena in a way that you don't necessarily see very often. Did you feel like you were sort of making some new territory? Not that it's never been done.
It's having kind of a moment in the last couple years. The Ferrante books, I think, created, Elena Ferrante is my brilliant friend, and then Neapolitan Quartet's created this conversation about female friendship, and we've seen a bunch of books lately. But it's funny, because when the book came out, I did have a couple people who were like, female friendship, such a fad, like, way to ride the trend. And I thought, like, this is so funny that you would say this, because female friendship and, like, girlhood, the power and intensity of adolescent friendship among girls is an enduring story that is formative to most women's experience of living and being in the world. So for me, I'm like, bring on these stories. There should be a female friendship, as many female friendship stories as there are, like marriage stories or stories of any other kind of relationship. But I was really interested in, I think, in the setting that I was writing in, and it's challenging to grow up as a girl in this world. And I don't mean to, we don't need to talk about that a lot, but in a place where there's a limited sense of opportunity, there's a lot of pressure to be a certain kind of girl and not another kind of girl. And the limits those put on how you feel you can express yourself, friendship, close female friendship can become a kind of collaborative or like creative act where girls determine who they're gonna be in relation to that best friend. And sometimes that's positive and sometimes that's negative. Sometimes that's harmful when one of your friends is doing something self-destructive. Sometimes it challenges you to grow in interesting ways. And it can absolutely, I think, change your life. And also the intensity of those friendships, I do think, fade as we grow older and have jobs, partners, children, other lives. So I was really, really interested in that kind of fraught territory. And to me, it seemed like something I wanted to pay tribute to, I think.
And also this notion of looking back and remembering it. And because we know early on that Marlena will die, we also know she's not here to tell her part of the story. And we see Kat having these moments where she's like, there's some things I'm not telling you.
Yeah, the incredible frustration. If you've lost anyone, you, I'm sure, know this feeling of even the act of remembering them distorts it changes the memory. Telling a story about someone you've lost, then you remember the story that you tell about the lost person, not the kind of like gut feeling of that memory as much. You can kind of paint over it with these retellings and mythologizing. And I wanted to capture that aspect of grief, definitely.
And Gabe, you touched on this a little bit before, but I think it bears further conversation, the sense of what some people would call an unreliable narrator, which is really all of us, right? So how do you handle the sense that this is how this character sees himself, and then there are these moments where someone else comes in and just drops a line of dialogue that helps the reader know that what's happening in Stephen's head is not exactly what's happening out in the real world? How do you kind of, you're fascinated by that landscape as well.
I am, yeah. I mean, my book is sort of the opposite of Julie's. Julie's has the retrospective and it deals with memory. Mine's present tense, so it's what I said earlier. I made that decision because this is a, you know, span of Stephen's life that is the most important part of his life to him, like at that moment. And he, whatever exists beyond that season, I mean, this isn't a spoiler, but the book ends at the end of the season. And sort of what comes after is totally irrelevant to the narrative perspective during the course of the novel. And also sort of his past is sort of irrelevant. Like, he's just sort of states in the first couple pages that his parents are dead. He doesn't really think about them that much, except for when his mind tends to wander. But yeah, the unreliability aspect was always something I wanted to incorporate. And I just think it adds a fascinating layer. And if it was, you know, if it tried to represent some sort of more objectivity, I guess, is if that's even possible in a novel, it would just lose this layer of this dynamic layer that Stephen brings to the narrative, because he's implicating the reader and he's telling the reader. I mean, all you get is, for the most part, you get, like, as you said, you get these little glimpses where you, as the reader, sort of maybe don't, you can see that he's maybe exaggerating something or he's leaving something out. And I wanted those moments to, you know, jolt the reader out of the sort of familiarity they've been developing with his voice, which sort of lulls you into what he says is happening. And particularly towards the end of the book, from a story perspective, the unreliability starts to play a huge part in what we as the reader think is maybe actually happening. And so that's building that sense of question in the reader as it goes along was something that I always thought was fascinating.
How did having his voice in your head for the extended period of time sort of affect you? How did you manage that voice?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I always knew his voice was going to be this sort of wild engine that pushes the book forward. And I never even considered it from third person or from a more distant POV. But having it in my head for so long was, I don't know, it's weird because he's not me, and there's not a lot of...
You didn't even wrestle.
No, and yeah. I was not a wrestler. So yeah. There's not a lot of autobiographical elements to the book, but yeah, it's sort of like if you took the way that I think and speak and just like run it through a bunch of different processes and make it this totally new adulterated thing. It was almost just like throwing my voice or being like a ventriloquist or something like that, and having this parallel world of thinking for, you know, years. So
yeah.
It's a little claustrophobic, but yeah, I signed up for it.
And we sign up for it as readers as well. So Gabe Havish is the author of Stephen Florida, a novel, and Marlena, a novel by Julie Bunton. They joined us here at the South Dakota Festival of Books. Thank you so much for the work, and thank you for spending time with us today.